In just a moment, biographies in sound. But first, everyone who's attended the motion picture this year will want to be on hand tomorrow night for the big announcements of the new Academy Award winners. Who will win is anybody's guess. Will it be Susan Hayward for I'll Cry Tomorrow, Katharine Hepburn for Summertime, Frank Sinatra for The Man with the Golden Arm, or any of the other fine actors and actresses nominated? Join your host, Jerry Lewis, and Claudette Colbert tomorrow night, and you'll find out. By the way, you'll enjoy some of the best variety entertainment, too. Now, stay tuned for Biographies in Sound on NBC.
This is a biography in sound.
My father thanks you. My mother thanks you. My sister thanks you. And as for myself, that goes without saying.
The National Broadcasting Company presents They and You, George M. Cohan.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy.
The voice of America's favorite song and dance man.
Real-life nephew of my Uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July.
And the voices of those who knew him.
I have known George M. Cohan because my father grew up with him in a small town in New England called North Brookfield, Massachusetts, just outside of Worcester.
The first time I met George M. Cohan was in Mr. Dennis O'Brien's office.
Well, I first saw George M. Cohan not on the stage, but around the Central Park Reservoir here in New York City.
I met George M. Cohan along about 1915 in Chicago. I used to meet him down at the theater. At that time, he was operating a house known as Cohan's Grand on Clark Street.
I know George M. all my life.
I'm going to go back to when I first saw George. It was in 14th Street.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. A Yankee Doodle do a lie. A real life
nephew of... They knew George M. Cohan, a biography in sound of one of the most fabulous figures in show business history. His story is told in rare recordings of his own voice, by the voices of those who knew him, and by the comments of Kenneth Banghart.
George Michael Cohan was born on the eve of the 4th of July in Providence, Rhode Island, in 1878. His father, Jerry, was one of the Cohans from County Cork in Ireland. His mother, Helen, was of the Costigan clan, herself born in Providence. Both were troopers playing in variety halls all over the country. Now they had come back to Providence to visit relatives, and there was born the prince of the American theater, the man who owned Broadway. He traveled with his parents almost from the time of his birth and made his stage debut at the age of 8 as a boy violinist.
It was a very special treat to me to know the Cohan family, especially George M. and his sister, who were very, very sweet people.
This is Mary Ramsey, a lifelong friend of George M. and the Cohan family. As George M. and his sister Josephine grew up, the family formed an act called the Four Cohans.
I met them first in a theatrical boarding house in Boston, Boston being my home, and they, at that time, always played at Keith's Bijou Theater. That was the name of it at that time. And, of course, back in those days, which is a long time ago, it wasn't considered the nice thing to go to vaudeville shows. I don't think we need to call them vaudeville even. I think it was variety. And we used to sort of steal up there without telling anybody we were going. George was always full of pranks in those days. And, of course, at that time he was only 14 or 15, which is the same age I was. And we thus thought he was the best of all things. He'd come around in a room with his violin and try to make a hit with all the girls by playing just especially to each one. There's one sweet thing about George M. While his mother was alive, there was never a day went by that he didn't either see her at her apartment or call her on the phone if he was out of town. He would never miss calling her. She always had heard from him every day.
For it is Mary, Mary, plain as any name can be.
But with propriety, society will
passions came.
And there is something there that sounds so square.
It's a grand old day.
George M. Cohan's first billing was Master George, Violin Tricks and Tinkling Tunes. Traveling all over the country, playing to all kinds of audiences, watching other performers, George M. learned every trick of the trade. And he learned what it meant to be a trooper, to take the bad with the good, and to always leave them laughing when you say goodbye. He published his first song when he was 13, began writing sketches and plays at 15, and in his early 20s appeared on Broadway for the first time in a musical play of his own, The Governor's Son. For the next 40 years, he was the greatest song and dance man of them all.
Well, I first saw George M. Cohan not on the stage, but around the Central Park Reservoir here in New York City.
This is Joe Franklin, a radio and television performer who specializes in collecting the recordings of show business entertainers. The recordings of songs by George M. that we hear are original copies from the Franklin Collection and were made almost 50 years ago. Other songs, all written by George M. Cohan, are presented by Fred Waring and his Pennsylvanians, or George M. Cohan Jr. and the Gill Choristers.
I was wandering around the reservoir on a chilly spring day, and I came upon this dapper-looking fellow feeding the pigeons. And I don't know how it happened, but I don't know. I was a reporter for my high school newspaper, and I asked him if I couldn't interview him for the publication. He said, well, it's kind of snappy out here in the park, kid. He called everybody kid, I later found out. He said, why don't you come over to my house for dinner one night? We made the date, and I was up there a couple of nights later, and we had a wonderful dinner. I asked him if he had ever made any records. He said, yes, kid, I did make a couple of records back in the old days. As a matter of fact, I might have one in my closet. And he went digging. He brought me out an old one-sided record. But I've got to bring out one little gag, if you want to call it a gag, of Cohan's. I asked him why he only made 7 records when the other people, such as the Jolsons and the Cantors and the others, made thousands and thousands. Well, he must have been kidding. He said, Joe, the reason that I only made 7 records in my life is I felt that if the people in the small towns heard the way I sing off key, they'd never come to see me when I came to their towns to play my performances. But one thing we ought to bring out, these records, which are almost a half century old, definitely don't even begin to recapture the wonder of this great and brilliant Yankee Doodle Dandy. The only thing we can do when we do hear one of these records is try and visualize that wonderful man running up and down the stage with his bamboo cane, that sly wink in his eye, that famous gray derby. And even from these old scratchy records, we can imagine a little bit of the magic that was the Yankee Doodle Dandy.
I've been around a bit, around a bit. I've met a lot of girlies and I'm proud of it, proud of it, proud of it. But Cupid kinda tipped me that the time has come to quit. I'm in love, just as sure as any fellow ever was in love. And that's no kid. Lots of things I'd like to go and tell her, but she wouldn't understand me if I did. I don't know what to say. She's such a little jay. She can't tell a bead from a pearl. She's not that kind of a girl. She doesn't know a blessed thing she hadn't ought to know. She knows just enough, and that's as far as she can go. She isn't the kind that feels to miss the wise guy that slaps you on the back and calls you pal. I've seen them all. I'm going to fall for a small town girl.
George M. Cohan wrote more than 200 songs. He wrote 40 plays of his own and wrote 40 more in collaboration. Over the years, he made more than 10,000 appearances behind the footlights. As a youngster, he was a brash, wisecracking kid who was a terror to stagehands and other performers. But he also had a capacity for making lifelong friendships.
I met George M. Cohan along about 1915 in Chicago. I was on the Chicago Tribune as a police reporter, and I used to meet him down at the theater. At that time, he was operating a house known as Cohan's Grand on Clark Street. After the World War I, I came out of the Army, and I joined George M. Cohan, going from the Chicago papers to New York.
This is Charles Washburn, a veteran newspaper man, author, and theatrical press agent.
I remained with George M. Cohan 23 years. During those 23 years, you get pretty close to a fellow like George. He was sensitive, bashful, shy. He probably didn't have 10 real close friends. George had a unique distinction of being the only man that I can recall who ever did everything in the... He did everything there's to be done in the theater. He not only financed the shows without any so-called backers that exist today, but he wrote the songs, all of them, no collaborator. He wrote the story. George had a peculiar talent. He wrote a show that played in Chicago for 6 months, a show about Broadway long before it went to New York. He found people, something we don't do anymore. He found Victor Moore out of a vaudeville theater. And Victor Moore, Faye Templeton, became the stars of 45 Minutes from Broadway. Now, he was a great family man. He had a mother and a sister and a father, which were then known as the Four Cohans. Josephine was the first to die. That was a blow to him. Then his father died, and finally his mother. And George's hair gradually turned gray through these deaths. In 1 week, he had been out of the office for 1 week, and he returned after his mother's death, and he was a white-haired old man, and he was only about 52 or 3 years old.
Although George M. always demanded the best from himself and from his fellow workers in the theater, he had a rare gift of loyalty and generosity.
He released people he loved for pictures. He had Walter Houston under contract. Walter Houston had a chance to go to Hollywood. He violated all the rules. He never lived like the other current producers have contracts that are easily 3 to 4 feet in length. They stipulate every detail. Cohan's contracts were a handshake or a letter, which he agreed to whatever it was. And when it came to a question like Walter Houston getting a big offer in Hollywood, he released Walter Houston. He also released Clark Gable from a contract. Cohan, in both instances, to give these men a break in Hollywood, jumped into their roles, and overnight he jumped into a play called Gambling to release Clark Gable. And George, those were the things. He loved his friends even perhaps more than he did the theater, but he had so few friends. He was actually bashful. Now, he was very fond of President Roosevelt, but Roosevelt and he didn't hit it off on some silly issue, and George was voted a congressional medal. He wrote the song Over There, and New York congressman promoted the idea that he should have a congressional medal. This medal was in Washington on President Roosevelt's desk for over 2 years. And over some silly argument, like two schoolboys, George wouldn't go to Washington to get the medal. And I remember the day that we went to accept the medal, Roosevelt put his arms around George, who was not a very... He was only about 5'3", wasn't a very tall man. And the president put his arms around George and says, I love you. And George, with tears in his eyes, told the reporters, he says, you know, he's not a bad guy after all.
H-A-R-R-I-G-A-N spells Harrigan. Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me. Divil a man can say a word again me. H-A-R-R-I-G-A-N-U-C is a name that a shame never has been connected with Harrigan. That's me. Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me. Divil a man can say a word again me. Is a name that a shame never has been connected with Harrigan. Harrigan, that's me.
George M. Cohan had a strong feeling for his friends and his family. This is his cousin, Lila King.
The very first time that I saw George M., I had gone to school at a convent, St. Joseph's Academy, in Mount Vernon, New York. And I used to come down for weekends to see the show. And, of course, that really gave me the idea that nothing was worthwhile except show business.
Later, Lila King went into show business herself. When George's sister Josephine became ill, Lila King took her place in the four Cohans.
It was very interesting to work with George M. due to the fact that he could rehearse, and at the same time he'd get an idea of a song, and he'd stop everybody and go over and call his musical director to make notes. And he would write a song, and particularly this one song that I know that he wrote in The Little Millionaire was "Honest Little Girlie, I'm Strong for You." He stopped everything, and he started humming, and the first thing you know, there was a number put to it. So he was very unusual with everything he did, and the fact that he wrote, he rehearsed, put on the dances. There wasn't anything that he didn't do in regards to the show all by himself without any help.
My gal May, I meet her every day. In fact, we used to go to school together. My gal May, she stole my heart away, but then she gave me hers, so what's the weather? My gal May is nothing but a jay. In fact, we both were born in old New Haven. When we stray every day, the fellas say such things. This is how they're all a-raving. Hey there, May there, who's the roving with ya? Say there, how'd he get the comical, peculiar bones on? Looks as though we had his father's Sunday clothes on. Hey there, May there, will you ever lose the jay?
One of George M. Cohan's longtime friends was the theatrical producer, the late Harry Frazee Sr. Here's his son, Harry Frazee, who grew up in show business and who's had a long career in radio and the theater.
I'm struck always by the great versatility and vitality of the one man that the word genius could be applied to in the American theater over the past 50 years. I was privileged to know him very, very well. And to show the actual versatility, it was nothing for Mr. Cohan to have both a musical, a review, and a dramatic show going at one time on Broadway. Now, each one of these shows he wrote, produced, and directed, and on the musical end, he composed the scores. It was nothing for him to be rehearsing one show in the last 2 or 3 weeks of a show he was currently playing in. He would be rehearsing and composing another show. But his kindness was one of the greatest things about him. During the rehearsal and final dress rehearsal of a farce comedy called A Prince There Was, in which George Parsons was playing one of the leads, one of the great farceurs of the time, but playing opposite Mr. Cohan, he was the producer, director, and owner of the show. He was a little bit reluctant to sort of take over and grab values that belonged to him. So after the dress rehearsal, I happened to go backstage and into Mr. Cohan's room, and here he was with George Parsons telling George to stop worrying. Be sure and get everything that was coming to him. Never worry about me. I will always get mine, said Mr. Cohan, and he always did. In reference to his terrific sense of timing and sense of humor, Georgette, his oldest daughter, had opened in a show called Genius and the Crowd. And my dad and I happened to run into him one day on our way over to the Astor for lunch. And we happened to ask him, how is Georgette's show going? And he said, I imagine quite well, but I'm afraid there's too much genius and not enough crowd. Another great instance of his complete kindness and thoughtfulness was on the passing of my father. He moved in and stayed with me for 2 solid weeks, and his counsel and guidance was forever and still is appreciated. He spent his life wanting to make people happy. Every show he ever did, his theme was making people happy.
It's the same old song they sing. I love you. The boys are all mad about Nellie, the daughter of Officer Kelly. And it's all day long they bring flowers all dripping with dew. And they join in the chorus of Nellie Kelly, I love you.
A stage-struck youngster named Ward Morehouse first saw George M. Cohan at the local theater in his hometown of Savannah, Georgia, back in 1913. Later, he came to New York and became a reporter, drama critic, and columnist for the New York Sun. At present, he's a feature writer for the North American Newspaper Alliance, the author of books on travel and the stage, and the writer of George M. Cohan's biography, subtitled The Prince of the American Theater.
George M. Cohan was a kid off the streets who moved right in and took over the American theater. As a play producer, in partnership with Sam H. Harris, one of the great gentlemen of our time, Cohan specialized in hits. The name of Cohan and Harris generally spelled success. I knew Cohan for many years. First met him when he was playing in The Meanest Man in the World. I saw him often when he lived at the Hotel Ambassador, later when he lived at the Savoy Plaza, and after he'd taken a many-room apartment at 993 Fifth Avenue. It was there, during lunch one day, that he suggested that we take a walk around the reservoir in Central Park. We did. When we finished the circuit, I was ready to quit, just about exhausted. But Cohan said, "Shall we try it again? All Irishmen are great walkers." I often went with him to the ball games, to the Yankee Stadium, and to the Polo Grounds. I once saw him give a $5 bill to the ticket taker at the Polo Grounds. He frequently gave $2 tips to taxi drivers, and most taxi drivers knew him. I never saw him let anyone else pick up a check. He frequently entertained from 10 to 20 people at dinner in his suite at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. I stood with him at the window, Arlington Street side of the Ritz, one afternoon when he pointed down at the pond in the public garden. "See that pond, kid?" he said. He called everybody kid, everybody that he liked. "That's where I learned to skate in my boyhood, if I ever had any boyhood." Cohan loved baseball. His father took him to a game in the Oranges out in New Jersey when he was 8 or 9 and said, "This is a game I want you to like." George M. liked it all his life. He would go to the local ball games, take a seat far up in the upper stands, sometimes in the lower stands, pull his black hat down just above his eyes, and stay silent for 9 innings. On his way back to town in a taxi, he would review the entire game. He could recall it play by play. Cohan wasn't taken seriously as an actor until later in his career. He won raves from the critics, particularly from Hayward Broun and Percy Hammond, when he appeared in Eugene O'Neill's Our Wilderness and when he came forth in his own melodrama, Gambling. The bar at the Oak Room of the Plaza was his favorite hangout, and the words upon the bronze plaque in the northwest corner, put there in his honor, have been read by many thousands. Cohan wrote the greatest song of World War I, Over There. He wrote the chorus one morning at his home in Great Neck, and the rest of it as he was driving into town. Cohan wrote hundreds of songs. He earned several millions in dollars. He had a great career in the theater. But in his last years, he was somewhat bitter and embittered, perhaps resentful of a theater he was no longer interested in and that he didn't understand. When I last saw him, and this was at the Oak Room Bar of the Plaza, just after the closing of his last play, The Return of the Vagabond, his hair was white, his face was ruddy, his figure was boyish, and he still talked out of a corner of the mouth. But there was sadness in his eyes. It was then he said, "Kid, they don't want me anymore. I guess I won't be doing another play." And he never did.
Biography in Sound will continue after a pause for station identification. This is a Biography in Sound. They knew George M. Cohan. George M. Cohan first came to Broadway as one of the four Cohans. That was at the turn of the century, a glamorous period when Broadway was truly the great white way. In a few years, he formed a partnership with Sam H. Harris, and their success became a theatrical legend. One hit followed another, and George M.'s name became famous all over the country. But New York was his town. Manhattan was his home. Broadway was his main street, and Central Park was his backyard. As a boy, he had spent many of his vacations at North Brookfield, Massachusetts. One of his boyhood friends was the late Dennis O'Brien, whose friends called him Cap. This is Paul O'Brien, the son of Dennis, who worked with his father as Cohan's legal advisor.
I have known George M. Cohan because my father grew up with him in a small town in New England called North Brookfield, Massachusetts, just outside of Worcester. The Cohan family, the four Cohans, would be trooping about the country during the winter time, and in the summer, the four Cohans would come back to North Brookfield to spend the summer. George M. Cohan and my father played on the same ball teams together and got to be very intimate friends. Subsequently, after my father had been secretary to Senator Aldrich down in Washington and graduated from Georgetown Law School, he went back to Providence to practice law, and he received a call one day from George Cohan in New York, who was then climbing to his success, and he asked him to come to New York to be his attorney. From that time forth, which was about 1906, they were intimate friends until George M. died. He was with George M. during the years that he formed his partnership with Sam Harris. Sam Harris had been the manager for Terry McGovern, and George met him, and together they went into show business. They were close personal friends, and George's business relationship with Sam Harris, much like all of his business relationships, was built upon a personal fondness and trust. He loved Sam Harris, and during their all-long association, the Cohen and Harris firm never had a contract other than a handshake between the two principals. Their success at the turn of the century was really based on the fact that the plays they were producing were indigenous to the American people. Prior to that time, the shows that were produced on Broadway were daily productions from England and other imports, which were either Shakespeare or of that general nature. For the first time, when Cohan and Harris presented a show, the people could recognize their own friends and portrayals of their next-door neighbors and their own problems and things that sprang from the soil of America itself. Furthermore, as is well known, George M. Cohan was a great patriot and was not ashamed to show that patriotism in his shows and in his plays.
I want to hear a Yankee Doodle tune played by a military band. I want to hear a Yankee Doodle tune, the only music I can understand. Oh, Sousa, won't you write another march? Yours is just the melody divine. Now you can have your William Tell, your Faust and Lohan Grinnell well, but I'll take a Yankee Doodle tune for mine.
George M. Cohan traveled all over the United States and made many trips abroad. He stayed at the best hotels, dined at the finest restaurants, belonged to the most exclusive clubs. He knew famous and influential people everywhere. But you didn't have to be famous to gain his friendship. As secretary to Dennis O'Brien, Ida Cohn knew George M. for many years.
The first time I met George M. Cohan was in Mr. Dennis O'Brien's office. And I was really surprised to see a man of such small stature. I knew, of course, that he's very popular in the theater, and I expected to see a man of at least 6 feet, 6 inches tall. He was a very gentle person, kind, and very well-mannered, of course. He wore very natty clothes, of the same type most of the time, very meticulous, and a charming person. It was so sweet and charming of this man, who was so famous in the American theater, to refer to his father with such humility as my daddy.
It's awfully nice of all you boys to see me to the train.
So long, Mary.
I didn't think you'd care if you should never see me again.
You're wrong, Mary.
This reminds me of my family. On the day I left Schenectady,
to the depot we came and put you on the train.
So long,
so long,
so long,
so long, so long, Mary.
Bye-bye, boys, I'm gonna miss you so.
We'll miss you so long, Mary.
Bye-bye, boys, I really hate to go.
We'll miss you.
Many performers who have become stars grew up with George M. Cohan as their idol and their ideal. One of them was a kid in vaudeville who was a protege of the famous Gus Edwards, the star maker, who toured with such headline acts as School Days. Later, George Jessel became one of the great show business personalities of our time.
We used to meet in the little corner of the Oak Room in the Plaza Hotel. We'd come then, have a tiny drink and chat and take a walk, maybe around the park. And then George would reminisce and talk about the New York that he knew as a very, very young man. And then the New York that I knew when I was a very young man. Then we'd come back and have dinner and sit and chat. And sometimes stay there till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then I'd walk him home. I met George M. Cohan personally in 1918. I had seen him on Broadway and had seen him as a big star when I was a kid around the main street. And I'd never met him until the night of November, it was, in 1918. I was playing at a vaudeville theater in Baltimore, Maryland. And George M. had a play down there called The Genius in the Crowd. And we took that late Saturday night train out of Baltimore that leaves there at 2 o'clock in the morning. I got down about 12:30 and was walking around before getting on the car, the sleeping car, and I saw him. And like the average baseball player, minor league player, when he saw Babe Ruth, or like some humble private in the army when he saw General Marshall or General Pershing, I stood at attention. George M. Cohan was the greatest amusement talent or theatrical talent that probably the world has ever known. George M. could just do everything. He could write a comic play, a farce. He could write a melodrama, a mystery play. He could write the music for a musical show or a popular song. Or he could play any part in any of the plays that he's written and play every character. There was something about him. He could just walk in a room and every head would be turned toward him. They knew he was something. And he was awfully kind to me because he was very tolerant of a young, ambitious fella. And after that night that I met him on the train, I introduced myself, and he said that he hadn't seen me, but his mother had seen me in vaudeville, and she liked the way I talked to my mother over the telephone and my act. And I got a great thrill that he'd ever heard anything about me, and I thought, sure, the next time I met, he'd give me a job in one of his shows. And I came and asked for one. And he said to me, Georgie, I know you'll understand this because you're a smart little guy. You don't want a job with me. You wait a little while and you write something for yourself, see? You put yourself in a show because you wouldn't want to say the kind of words that I'd write for you. You'd like to make them up yourself. You've done pretty well so far, and you keep on doing that. And I love you. You're my pal, kid, but take my advice. And he was right. The little measure of success that I've had in the amusement business was based on the fact that I had to do the things that I had written for myself, as he did. George M. Cohan is the happiest portrait that has ever been painted of an American showman, playwright, author, and composer of songs that will never be forgotten. I could go on for hours and hours, but my eyes would just fill up. They just fill up.
George Jessel, one of the many troopers who carry on the George M. Cohan tradition. One of the first friends George M. made in New York at the turn of the century was Walter J. Moore, who remained his friend for 40 years. As head of the Minor Lithograph Company, which made theatrical posters, Walter Moore knew most of the great names in show business. But to him, there was always only one George M. Cohan.
One of his outstanding features of the in accepting encores and so forth was to make a speech embodying the whole four. My mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you. And bow and go up the side of the stage, run up the proscenium, and off. And that was his finish. He wouldn't come off any more bows. George had little Johnny Jones on his shoulder, see, all himself. Frome wanted a bit of it, Erlang wanted the Schuberts, but he didn't want, he wasn't interested. He wanted to be the boss and so forth. There was too much highbrow with those fellas, see. But he got in, he's in rather financial difficulty. He didn't have enough money for the show. So he used to write out the checks and leave him so and so. Charlie Stum then was the manager. So Stum, he had a desk in my office. The H.C. Minor Company, 1358 Broadway. So, Stum would say to me, will you forget this guy to sign those checks, will you, so-and-so, everybody wants so-and-so, so-and-so. So, George come up the office, and I'd give him the signal from me, over the Marlboro, come on up, he's not here. So I said, why don't you get somebody that take all this responsibility off your shoulders, and you shouldn't be worried with this thing. Well, he said, who do you mean? Who would you recommend? And just as I said that, Sam Harris walks in the doorway, say, of my office. I said, Sam, come here a minute. I said, you want to meet George M. Cohan? I said, have you met each other? Well, I've in this, but never intimately, don't you know? I said, so-and-so. Well, shake hands. Sit down, Sam, and get talking one thing another, and this and that led to a conversation. And 3 or 4 days afterwards, they went down and played baseball in Staten Island for the song in the Words of Music Club. And they come back, they were partners. Sam pitched and George caught. When I introduced Sam Harris to Cohan, he had a couple of $100,000. See? He was manager Terry McGovern, see? He'd made that, so forth, so forth. Comes to New York with all this money, and he's sent from heaven. In the meantime, Harris keep crazy about the horses. Somebody sells him an idea, I think it was Paddy Sullivan's, Big Tim's brother, and they buy a stable of horses. In 3 months, they're both broke. Harris and Sullivan, both of them. And so they're right back with the Cohan show on his hands without the bankroll, see? So they fight the show on. George borrows some money in one place, and Harris gets $10,000 from Big Tim Sullivan. I dug him up a few live ones. And the show goes out anyway. We had to go and dig for the money anyway. But of course, what I thought, when the Harris and Cohan got together, the financial troubles were over. But the show was a big hit. Little Johnny Jones, the first show, and from there on, they went on to fame and glory, Cohan and Harris.
On April 24, 1938, Walter J. Moore was one of the hundreds of old friends who gathered at a testimonial dinner for George M., given by the Catholic Actors Guild. At the age of 60, he had retired from the theater several times. Perhaps he felt that the parade had passed him by, that a more sophisticated America, in his own words, didn't want him anymore. However, he had returned to star in Our Wilderness, the Pulitzer Prize play by Eugene O'Neill. After years apart, he had once again gone into partnership with Sam H. Harris. At the time of the dinner, he had put on his dancing shoes again to appear in the musical comedy I'd Rather Be Right. On this night, he and his friends were looking back over more than 50 years in the theater.
I really want to introduce myself as one of George's and perhaps the oldest friend that George Cohan has got. He may not know it, but it's true, because my experience with George goes back many, many years. He doesn't even remember when it began. It began with his dear old dad, Jerry.
That was Otis Skinner, a great dramatic star, at the Catholic Actors Guild dinner in 1938. As he spoke, the crowd remembered the wonderful nights when a younger George M. introduced such songs as this.
My regards to Broadway, remember me to Herald Square. Tell all the boys at 42nd Street that I will soon be there. Whisper up how I'm yearning to mingle with the old-time throng. Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
Another speaker that night was the late Major Edward Bowes, then at the peak of his radio popularity.
All right. It isn't easy to analyze just what quality it is, or a combination of qualities that causes hearts to open and take you in. But whatever that quality is, George Cohan has it to a superlative degree. His gifts are many and great, though he is modest in proclaiming them. But there are others who have great gifts. There are others who have accomplished extraordinary things. But I believe there are no others who have such a place as his in the hearts of the American people. I remember him in the days of the Four Cohens. I remember the governor's son. I remember his splendid father, his lovely mother, and his beautiful, gifted sister. Of all of George M. Cohen's varied qualities, one in particular, I believe, appeals most to me. His gentleness, his softness, his kindness, his faculty for giving happiness. I think of him as one to whom you might say, won't you come into my garden? I'd like my roses to see you.
These were George M.'s friends, most of them friends for many years. As they looked at him, many of them could recall the brash, smiling, fast-stepping youngster who brought the audience to its feet with...
You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, forever it keeps me away. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old flag.
One of the main speakers of the evening was a man who loved New York in the way that George M. did. He was the former governor of the state and one-time candidate for the presidency, the late Al Smith.
Well, I'm not going to speak about years, but I'm going to go back to when I first saw George. It was in 14th Street. And he was playing in a little comedy, running for office. And listen, it was before I began to run, and that's a long time ago. It was before the development of the automobile. It was before we knew anything about airplanes as passenger carriers. And it was before the income tax. And that saved, certainly, a long time ago. Now, I don't know whether you've ever noticed this or not, but it's apparent to me that history is recorded largely in song. There were songs connected with the Civil War, songs connected with the Spanish War. But of all the war songs that I remember, none gave greater inspiration to the marching millions than did the song expressing the devotion of America to the cause of world civilization, and we won't come back until it's over. Over there.
Over there!
A little something in common. I came from the lower end of Manhattan. I was born in the last house on South Street. Below me was junk shops and dealers in marine hardware and paints and so forth that was required for the clipper trade of the late 80s and the early 90s. Naturally, with a great devotion to downtown, I just listened to George when he sang, "Come on downtown. Come on with me. Come on downtown. We'll have a jubilee. Herald Square, I've been there, but it's not for mine. Come on downtown, I'll show you."
That was Alfred E. Smith, one of the most colorful and beloved figures of his time. It was a golden moment for George M. Cohan that night when he finally stood up to speak to his friends.
This gathering here tonight, it's more of a tribute to the memory of my father than anything else. And, of course, that makes it doubly thrilling to me. I realize that an occasion of this time that a man should really have sat down and prepared a substantial speech of some kind. But that, of course, that's asking a great deal of a song and dance man. Especially a song and dance man who tried so hard not to be a song and dance man. And then had to go back being a song and dance man in order to earn a living. About a week ago, the New York Times called me up, and the fellow on the phone asked me if I would send them an advance copy of my speech that I was to deliver at the Catholic Actors Guild dinner. And that kind of made a hit with me. I told him, I said, "Why?" I said, "I haven't any speech, at least not yet." Well, he said, "You know, the dinner's next Sunday." I says, "That's what I'm talking about, yes." And I tried to explain to him that I was the kind of a fellow that never even started to write a second act until the first act had been in rehearsal at least a week. He couldn't quite understand that, however. But that's the way it is. I remember very well when I was a playwright in the old days. A fella come up and ask me during the rehearsal of a first act, say, "What am I going to wear in the second act?" I had a set speech for him. I said, "Well, I don't know, but if you tell me what you'd like to wear, maybe you can give me an idea for a second act." I always wanted to be able to make a good speech all my life. I've been wanting to make a good speech. And I always wanted to play a good game of pool, too, but I somehow... I never could make the grade either way. I don't know why it was. However, I'm satisfied. It's all right. I'm glad to be working for Sam Harris. It's all right with me. He worked for me for 15 years. He didn't know it at the time, but he's found it out since, I guess. This Harris man, by the way, is a very surprising person. Full of surprises. I know he's handed me many a surprise. I don't mean by that that I didn't always know that he was a great showman, great judge of plays and all that sort of thing. But I mean, he's a surprising man. I remember the first time he surprised me. Of course, when Sam and I first went in business together, I naturally thought Sam had a lot of money, you know. Now, we didn't talk about that until we were in the middle of rehearsals of our first show. And when he told me he was broke, that was my first surprise. He seemed to be just as much surprised as I was when I told him I was broke, too. And the members of the company were very much surprised when they found out we were both broke. However, we did all right. We went along for a long time. Eventually, we had a lot of shows, and we got a lot of theaters. And I remember when we started to accumulate our theater interests, I remember I went to my father. I was a little bit worried about coming too involved. I told him what we were doing. I asked him, I said, do you think we ought to hang on to these theaters? And I remember my father's advice. I remembered very well. He said, well, I don't know much about whether or not you ought to hang on to the theaters, but you take my tip, kid, and hang on to your dancing shoes. But to get back to this speech business again, I read in the paper the other day, I was reading Mrs. Roosevelt's column. So you can see that I give the papers an awful reading. Reading where she told about some fellow that went around, that she'd watched him. I think it was 2 or 3 years. He'd been making the same speech no matter where he went. Made the same speech in the same way, same delivery, same inflection, same everything, same gestures, everything he did. She heard it. She said something like a half a dozen or a dozen times. It's always the same speech, and he always got away with it. Well, it's getting very late, and I'm going to tell you that I beat that fella to it. I made the same curtain speech for about 25 years. And I'm going to make that speech now. And I don't think I'm out of order making it. Because spiritually, I really think that my father thanks you, my mother thanks you, my sister thanks you. And as for myself, that goes without saying.
That was a night to remember and be thankful for, because during most of the few years that remained, George M. was ill. Shortly before he died in 1942, he caught one last glimpse of Broadway. He stopped at a theater where they were showing the film based on his life, Yankee Doodle Dandy. He stayed only a few minutes and then went home to wait for the last curtain call. The curtain call on a life that became a legend. The National Broadcasting Company has presented a transcribed biography in sound, They Knew George M. Cohan.